So, Nathan, thank you for coming on the podcast. I'm honored to have you here. Episode 104 originally in February of 2021. Now we're coming back for episode 400 something. And in that time, you've just continued to inspire me. You inspired me back then and you inspire me now. So it's remarkable to have you back here. And I'm really grateful and honored for your presence on this podcast.
Yeah, thank you. I was talking to someone on Twitter. They were referencing your work and all that. And I just said like, oh, if there were publicly traded stocks for individuals, like I would be buying lots of Danny Miranda stocks. So I think the way that you are doing the interviews, the deep dives, creating content, it's one of the things like I see a lot of creators playing short-term games where they're trying to maximize something for right now. And either they're getting that traction, like here's a little gimmick that I figured out and I'm only going to follow that gimmick because that's what worked to get views. Or they don't get traction. They're like, okay, I guess content creating wasn't for me. And so something that I see you doing is just like putting in all of the work every single week, no matter what. And it's going to pay off for you in a huge, huge way.
What separates people who do it, play short-term games and long-term games as creators?
Patience. And it's just like, how long are you willing to wait for like the feedback loop? Or actually even what are you looking for in that feedback loop? Right? Because if you're saying, okay, I've released this podcast episode, it got, I mean, honestly, if we're talking about most podcasts, it got 100 downloads, you know, 500. I think someone was saying a top, I don't know the stats, you know, but a top 3% podcast, top 5% podcast is like 10,000 downloads. You know, like it's not that many episodes or that many downloads to be considered a top 10% podcast. And so most people just don't get traction and they give up. And so I think it's, what are you looking for? What evidence are you looking for that you should keep going? And if you're looking, okay, I did 10 episodes, maybe I kind of enjoyed it, but it was hard. Like, but then I'm looking, did I get the results I wanted? No. Okay, well, maybe I shouldn't do it, right? And that's where you're saying, oh, my goal or the thing that I'm measuring success on is based on views. It's something that's out of my control. But if you're measuring success based on what am I learning? You know, how am I leveling up over time? Then like every single episode is a success and you could do 100 episodes or more, or, and we're talking podcasts, but it could be writing or video or anything else. And so I think it's all dependent on how you measure success. And if you measure success in something that is not within your control, you most likely get very frustrated and give up well before you're ever going to see that success.
That's, yeah, really well said. I think in addition to it, there's a piece of, would you be doing this if no one knew about it?
Mm. Yep.
The podcast started for me because I was having phone calls with people from Twitter. I said, who wants to talk on the phone? And I love doing that so much that I said, I should record these. And so it came from such an intrinsic place of the enjoyment of the phone call for you and writing. It's like, were you writing anyway in a journal or in your notes before you even published anything?
Well, yeah, like a bunch of the essays that I'm most known for. So like The Ladders of Wealth Creation, Billion Dollar Creator, or even the Creator Flywheels essay, these ones that have become like these flagship posts that people keep referring back to again and again are not because I set out to write like, okay, what's the best thing I could write about wealth? You know, how could I write an article that would get hundreds of thousands of views about wealth? Instead, it's me looking at the world and going, okay, there's something here that I understand. And then I go to explain it and I realize, ooh, maybe I don't understand it, right? I know it intuitively and I've observed it and lived it from, you know, my experience building businesses. But then I go to explain it and I'm like, it just works this way. This is how it works. And someone's like, why? And I'm like, I don't actually know. And so a lot of that writing is me trying to dig in at the level to be able to articulate why something is, right? Like, why is it that when people try to start a really, really hard business, when someone's like, I want to start a social network, why am I like, oh God, please don't do that. Like, like, why is that the business 100 times harder, 1,000 times harder than what they actually should start? You know, or why when someone moves from a freelance business to selling products, do they often make less money for years? And so those kinds of things, it's like this curiosity where I'm like, okay, I want to understand it so well that I feel like I can actually teach it. And that's the thing that I'm, you know, with all of my friends, I'm found like, okay, but why is this? What are the different shapes of wealth increase? And like, what are all these principles behind it? And then only then do I feel like you know, that I've researched it enough that I can write, you know, a 4,000 word essay on it. Then I'm like, okay, now I understand it well enough to explain it. And there we go. So it's not the quest for views or an audience. It's like the quest to understand it. And I feel like I only fully understand something when I can teach it.
How does that relate to your understanding of yourself by virtue of what you choose to talk about?
Oh, my understanding of myself. Like, in what way?
Like, how have you understood yourself better by virtue of, oh, I'm interested in billion-dollar creators. What does that say about me? I'm interested in flywheels. What does that say about me? I'm interested in creating an email business for creators. What does that say about me? Have you thought about that at all?
Yeah, well, I think about, like, the driving factor of why I want to do a lot of this. I'm fascinated with the topic of wealth creation and money. That's the thing that I could talk about absolutely forever. And, you know, the rest of this business stuff is just a proxy for a lot of that, right?
Mm.
You know, I don't care about email marketing because I love email marketing so much. I do think it's unique and novel, but it is a means to an end, right? It's not that I have an email marketing company and so I'm like, this is why email marketing is so great. Instead, it's early on when I was building, or like writing ebooks, I, you know, tried social marketing, email, SEO, a bunch of other things, and email absolutely crushed every other channel. And so then I was like, did y'all know this? Email converts better than, you know, every social channel combined. And my friends had been in direct response marketing for a long time. We're like, yeah, we've known that since 2001. Like, do you want a gold star? Like, what are you hoping for here? And so that's what, you know, got me starting an email company. But I think the core driver for me is understanding, like, helping both for myself and then helping other people make money and what that unlocks. So I grew up in a family where money was very scarce, right? And so watching, like, my parents often fight about money and just the amount of stress that it has. Like, people say, like, money doesn't buy happiness, which I disagree with. But on the other side, it's like a lack of money definitely contributes to unhappiness.
You said one time, after growing up poor, it brings me an unreasonable amount of joy every time I go into a grocery store knowing I can buy whatever I want.
Yep. That's exactly what I think. Because, like, yeah, I mean, I could send you a photo of the house that I was born in and all that, but it was a tiny house before tiny houses were cool.
Hmm.
And so somewhere in there, like, growing up watching the struggles around money and the conflict that comes from a lack of money, there's just so much stress from that. That when I saw that, somewhere when I realized that you can, really, that making money is a skill. And this is actually something I first learned from Jason Fried from Basecamp, where he talked about, like, you wouldn't expect to sit down at the piano or the drums and be amazing to begin with. And making money is the same way. People say, like, oh, you know, she had this business and it took off. She was really lucky. And you're like, you would, she's not really lucky that she's an amazing pianist, right? And, like, sure, luck is absolutely a factor in some of these things, but it's like, this is all skills that can be learned. And when I realized that, I was like, oh, like, I am going to get very, very good at the skills of making money so that I never have to, like, go through the same stress that, like, my parents did, that my kids don't have to go through that same stress that I did as I and my siblings went through as kids. And so that's been a huge driver for me. And then somewhere in there, it was when I felt like it turned from theory to practice of, like, okay, yeah, making money is a skill. Like, let's figure this out. And then as you get into building an audience and I'm like, wait, no, these are real skills. You can learn this. And I think that anyone who's willing to put in that level of work can. Then I was the person who's like, do you know this? Do you know this? Like, I feel like I just discovered something that's insane. And I'm like, so excited that I can't not tell people about it. And so that's where the blog and really ConvertKit and everything else, right? ConvertKit's mission is we exist to help creators earn a living. And so everything comes from that, of just this excitement of, like, we all just figured out something insane. And I can't believe, like, you understand. I can't believe you don't understand it yet, you know? And so it's like, how do we spread this as much as possible? Because it's just, it's phenomenal to think that you can get to a place through, like, very deliberate practice where you can walk into a grocery store and you're like, I could buy absolutely anything I wanted in here.
What were some of the beliefs that you had to overcome in the early days of the reasons why you couldn't make money?
I'm trying to think of what beliefs those would be.
And if you didn't have any beliefs, why not? Why you grew up a certain way? Why did you believe you were different or you could expand beyond your circumstances?
Well, I mean, one of the first beliefs was it takes money to make money. I remember hearing that. And there's an element of truth to it, right? If you, like me, if you want to learn web design in high school, you need a computer. I got my parents to buy me a copy of Photoshop Elements for whatever it was, $50 or $100 at the time, right? And that's where I was first learning web design. And so, like, it takes a basic level there. But I don't think I had that many limiting beliefs because even though I grew up without money, I grew up in a family where they were very, very encouraging, like this you can do anything kind of belief. Hmm. Like, my dad built the house that we grew up in. My mom started multiple businesses. Both my parents were constantly learning, always reading books, always encouraging whatever we were doing. We had a pet sitting business as kids, you know, of like families going on vacation for a week. And so we would charge, I'm thinking back, $10 a day to come and, like, you know, feed someone's cat and, like, let them out and all of that. I remember thinking, like, wait a second, you're going to pay me $70. And all I have to do is, like, walk over to your house 7 times and just, like, I'm there for 20 minutes. Like, this is amazing.
Sign me up.
Yeah.
How do I do this more? How do I show people that I can do this?
Yeah, exactly.
How do I start tweeting about
new ebook about how to start a business?
Cats and
So, you know, like, my parents were really encouraging on those things. I think my dad, having built our house, we had not like fancy tools or anything, but we had a wood shop. And so I used that a bunch. And then some of my early opportunities making money was like making woodworking products and selling them either door to door or like at a craft fair or something like that. So I remember my mom, I was probably 12 or 13, my mom helping me like man a booth at the craft fair. My parents were just always encouraging those kinds of things. And just like, yeah, if you want to go after something, absolutely do it. And then the other side is I was homeschooled. And so a lot of my education was very personalized and tailored to me, right? Where it was at the pace, like one example, I grew up in the mountains outside of Boise. And so I remember one day, it was snowing and it was just the most perfect snow. I was like, oh, man, I just want to go sledding. And like, I have, I don't know, pre-algebra in front of me, right? Or something. And I'm like, oh, I want to go sledding and I really don't want to be inside doing this. And my mom just says to me, like, look, you don't have to do this for a fixed number of hours. It's a fixed amount of work. When this math lesson is done and this, you know, and your next subject is done, like, you're done. You can go sledding. And so, like, you've never seen a more focused, like, 12-year-old than like, because, like, oh, you know, I can just do this. I don't have to wait for, you know, the kid next to me in class to finish or whatever else. It's just like, this is all on me. So power through that, and then I'm out there sledding. And then the other one that had a huge impact is, as I got a little older, I spent a lot of time with my older siblings who were 2.5 and 5 years older than me. And so at like church youth group and that sort of thing, I'd be, you know, my brother would be driving there. And so I'd be tagging along with them and I'd just like tag along with them and their friends quite a bit. And so because of that, a lot of my friends were older than me. And I always thought of myself as older than I was. I was in a hurry to grow up. But something, I was probably 13 or 14 when I realized like, oh, we're not all actually the same age. Right. And this is going to become really apparent when you all go off to college and I'm still stuck in high school. Hmm. And so then I was talking to my mom about it, and I was like, hey, is high school a fixed amount of work, or is it a fixed amount of time?
Mm.
And she's like, it's a fixed amount of work. Like, wow. Your older siblings have got, like, we've already mapped out what high school curriculum looks like for homeschooling. And so go ahead and dive in and, you know, here's the work. However fast you complete it, you can graduate. So I remember thinking, we do these family road trips from Boise to Seattle. It's like an eight or nine hour drive. And, you know, before iPads. And so I was like, I'm really bored on this road trip. I'm also bored when I'm doing algebra. So why don't I combine the two? And my older brother, who's probably 17 or 18 at the time, would be sitting, he'd be in the car too. So I'd like ask for his help and we'd work this. And so I would do like a month's worth of, you know, of math lessons in a drive to Seattle. And so I ended up graduating when I was 15, a little bit before I turned 16, because my parents were like, you set the pace. And actually Derek Sivers in his book, Anything You Want, has a chapter called, I think it's called You Set the Pace or...
The Average Pace is for Chumps.
The Average Pace is for Chumps. There you go. And he talks about going through music school, like, you know, a semester's worth of music theory in 2 or 3 hours and then testing out of the class and, you know, and going on from there. And I lived that. And I think that, like, that belief of, oh, I can do this at my own pace, whether that's slower or faster, has been absolutely huge for me.
Why do you think that obsession in figuring something out faster or just getting it done faster, why do you think that is demonized?
I don't know. Is it demonized?
It's not demonized in our world
yeah.
that we live in of you could do anything. You could do 3 podcast episodes a week and we live in this. But
there is this world where people are like, why don't you just enjoy life?
Exactly.
And you're like, I am.
Exactly. I'm enjoying it by doing 3 podcast episodes a week.
Someone's like, why don't you chill out and just do one? And be like, I would be having less fun.
Yes, exactly right. So like, what is going on there?
Oh, I don't know. I think that people, I think success intimidates people.
Mm.
And there's this whole idea. You know, I spent some time, this is in 2008, traveling around Lesotho and South Africa. We got to go visit some of these mountain communities. And one thing, we're traveling with someone who had brought in a lot of like, helped to teach more modern farming techniques in these like very mountainous communities, right? So how do you handle water management and stuff like that? And he was talking about how they would teach these techniques and some people would adopt them and then other people wouldn't. And it's like, that's fine. Everyone can do their own thing. But what would happen is like the people who implemented, you know, for their rice farms and all of that, who'd implement like a terraced hillside system for water management, making the most, you know, and maintaining water when it rains like crazy and then you have it in the drought and all this stuff. The people who would implement that, instead of other people going in the community going, oh, that's amazing. Like maybe I should do that too. Instead, they would come in at night and destroy it.
Wow.
And you hear about this, I think it's a phrase in New Zealand and maybe Australia as well, of tall poppy syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically where, you know, if someone rises above and it's like, oh, you think that, you know, you're better than us or whatever, then like that's what gets cut down. And so I think people are intimidated by that level of work. And instead of saying like, you know, Danny, I'm happy for you that you're willing to work super hard for this thing that you believe in, like go, you do you. And like, I'm going to take a different path. Which is 100% fine. People say like, you know, Danny, you probably shouldn't be doing that. Like, are you sure your goals are right? Do you only care about money? You know, there's more to life than, you know, just chasing, whatever people say, like just chasing views on YouTube, you know, but they're really talking to themselves and they're trying to do that rather than, yeah, it has nothing to do with you. It's all about their own internal story.
Yeah. They're trying to justify often taking less responsibility for doing the work.
Yeah. And I don't know, people will say things like work smarter, not harder. And like, absolutely work smarter, but like often it's just going to take a lot of hard work. I just feel like everyone, people get burned out and all of that. And there are downsides to a hustle culture and things like mm-hmm. that. But most of the people I hear talking about it have not actually ever worked up to what they're capable of.
Mm.
But it's like, if you and I were not runners and we're like, all right, and someone came and was like, all right, guys, we got to go run a 7-minute mile right now. We'd be like, oh God, there's no way.
Mm.
But if we had someone who knew what they're doing, came to us and said, hey, we're going to work on this. And a year from now, I'm going to coach you. A year from now, we got to be running 7-minute miles. We'd be like, no problem. Like, we can build up to that. And so I think most people don't realize that the skills, the habits, and the resilience, like, gets built over time by pushing those limits.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when they see someone else doing it, they're like, oh no, like, I don't want any of this. And I don't know. I like people who are saying, like, I'm capable of this now, and I'm going to go on a journey that's difficult enough that I know by the end of it, I'll be capable of, you know, 10 times as much.
What's the single most important habit you've developed in your life?
Patience.
Wow.
I don't know that it's a, you know, it's more of a character trait than, yeah, than a habit, but someone described it to me. They described me as short-term impatient and long-term patient. And that's one thing where, like, I am trying to, like, I want to start the compounding early. I want to get these systems going. I want to do the work. I want to have the meeting, whatever it is, to get this started now. And then I can be really, really patient for the results. So, like, with ConvertKit, it took 2 years to get to $2,000 a month in recurring revenue. Right. And then the very next year went from 2,000 to 100,000. And so, and there's a lot that went on in that. But this idea of being, like, I have a bunch of examples in my life of being long-term patient, paying off in a big way.
How do you actually cultivate that skill of being better at patience?
I think that it's a lot of mindset, a lot of thinking. Going back to earlier in the conversation of, what are you tracking as your results?
Hmm.
Right? Like, are you, if the thing that you're tracking is something out of your control, right? Then it's really hard, because you go through all of the steps of, like, say we're tracking revenue as our goal for building a software company, right? It's not actually within your control. That requires a bunch of people just say yes. And you can't, like, they all have free will. You can't just force them, you know? This isn't a criminal enterprise. We have to actually voluntarily get their money from them. We can't take it. And so you have to set the goal at something that you can control. So I remember hearing this podcast years ago on Mixergy, so Andrew Warner's show. And this guy, Trent Dearsmit, who actually randomly lives in Boise now and is a good friend of mine. We just went flying together the other day because he's a pilot now. And, but he talked about his first business. He was selling IT services in Vancouver, Canada. And he knew the thing he could control was how many cold calls he made to pitch his IT services. And so every day he had two jars on his desk. One had 50 paper clips in it. The other was empty. And he was done for the day when he had made 50 cold calls and he had moved all the paper clips from one jar to the other. That's something you can control, right? You can't control the deals closed, but you can control the inputs, right? So that's when you talk about lead measures versus lag measures. And so he focused entirely on the lead measures. And then once he built that habit, then he's like, okay, now that I know, you know, I've gotten over the fear of actually calling people, you know, I know kind of what works and I'm learning as I go. Now let me start tracking. Maybe I'm gonna be like, maybe I'm coloring the paperclips differently and I'm going, you know, I've got script A and script B, and then I'm gonna test which one's working better for conversions. Like, you can optimize from there. But if you were to start out and just say, oh, I'm gonna start this business and the metric that I care about is deals closed or revenue, like, okay, you just handed over your success and feeling of accomplishment and all of that to like a whole bunch of random strangers in the phone book. Like, can you imagine how bad that is? Like, when you phrase it that way, it's like, this is a terrible idea for you to, I mean, you're almost handing over your sense of self-worth to other people.
Yeah. When you say it like that, it's so remarkable. And I first heard of the paperclip story from James Clear in Atomic Habits, uh-huh. But it's interesting that maybe it originally came from
And I'm sure lots of people have done it, but I heard it from Trent Dearsmith in, I don't know, 2013 or 2012 on, yeah.
So around that time, you know, I was searching my name and your name on Twitter earlier, and I discovered that when you were building ConvertKit, I had tweeted it sometime in 2021 or 2022 that you went to a party and Andrew Warner, who we just mentioned, noticed you were stressed, and as a way to ease your tension, he went over to you and comforted you, and he lent you $25,000 on the spot. What in the world happened there?
Yeah. Oh man, that was fast. That, like, a wild time. So, in 2 years in, we're at 2,000 a month in revenue. The third year went from 2,000 to 100,000 a month, which is absolutely wild. And then year three, we went from, or I guess year four, from 100,000 to 500,000 a month in revenue.
What year is that?
So started in 2013. Hmm. So early 2015 was kind of the first year of 50x growth, and then 2016 would have been the only 5x growth. But you know, so what's interesting is, on the surface, that hockey stick is what we all want. Mm-hmm. But what actually happened, the mechanics of the business was really interesting, or I say interesting in hindsight. Crushing.
Crushing in the moment. Always. That's how it is. Always. Yeah.
But, you know, now we're acting like, so it was really interesting back then.
Funny looking back on it when it works out.
Yeah. So, but what happened is the money that we had in the bank was from, like, no money raised. It was entirely from customers. And so what happened is we would be making more money each month, but I'd be raising expenses right with it to try to, like, keep the lights on. And this creator, Matt Ragland, who came onto our team early on, he was maybe the third or fourth team member. When we hired him part-time. And then, like, 2 weeks later, we're like, hey, Matt, can you jump up to 30 hours a week? And he's like, yeah, okay. And then, like, 2 weeks after that, we're like, can you go full-time? And a couple years later, he was like, what was the deal with that? And I was like, oh, that was the exact amount of money we had. Right. Like, we could afford you part time. And then, like, revenue grew. And so then we could afford you more, you know, 30 hours and up from there. So that was happening all the time, where we were hiring people as fast as we had the money to do it. And so what ended up happening is, at the time that I ran into Andrew, I think I'd been a guest on Mixergy, and we talked a little bit. We're at about $120,000 a month in recurring revenue. Our expenses were about like $115,000 a month. And our cash in the bank was like $25,000 a month. So cash in the bank was growing every single month. We were always profitable, but it was shrinking as a percentage of days worth of expenses, right? Because if you've got 20 grand in the bank and your expenses are 20 grand a month, that's 1 month's expenses. Okay, that's terrifying, but it could be worse, right? We have a recurring revenue business. So long as Stripe doesn't shut off access, we'll be good. But then what happened, you know, as that grows significantly, it's like, wait, now we've got 2 weeks of expense in the bank. Now we've got 10 days. Now we've got 5 days. And so that was like, so long as nothing goes wrong, we're good. And talking to Andrew, he was hosting a whiskey night or scotch at his office. And I was down in San Francisco. And so I was there with a bunch of people. And he actually kind of like pulled me aside afterwards and was like, hey, man, you seem stressed. What's up?
It's on his end, it's so remarkable that he could notice.
Yeah.
And see just in your face or your demeanor that something was wrong. Yeah. Speaks to his skills as a podcast host and as a human being.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have so much respect for that man. But yeah, so we talked it over, and as we were leaving, like, we walked out together and all of that. And he said, hey, like, I want to help you out, and you may not ever need this money. And so basically what he did is he wired me $25,000, which almost doubled our cash on hand. I kept it in the company savings account, which I just want to say, like, just what an amazing privileged position it is to have friends like that. So he wired the money in, and then he said, the only thing is, like, hold the money for as long as you want, and just repay it whenever you want. or I was trying to decide if I was going to raise funding. And so he was like, or if you decide you raise funding, like consider that the first seed check or whatever. So the only thing is do not ever try to pay me interest. If you do, that'll piss me off. And I was like, okay, thanks, Andrew. Because I could imagine there was some like, oh, well, 5% interest, blah, blah, blah. I'm trying to pay him back like $26,000 or whatever. He's like, no, man, that is not, I'm not here to make any money off of this. This is just helping out an entrepreneur. And yeah, that was an amazing thing. And I'd love to do that for more people.
What do you think he saw in you or in that situation that made him so willing?
That's a good question. I don't know. We'd have to ask him. I think I could speculate of like the, like sticking with something for a long time when it's not working or, you know, or pushing through those things. But yeah, we'd have to ultimately ask him.
We will, I'm sure.
Which I think he's coming to the event tomorrow. So I think he's got to figure out some childcare. But yeah, it'd be good to see him again.
Oh my God. Well, I got to ask him that. Speaking of the event, you are going around the country,
yep,
starting a podcast and hosting live events wherever you go. There you are. And there 100 people are there to greet you and show up to you in those cities. Austin, Los Angeles, you said Miami, New York.
We did New York, Nashville, and New Orleans. Yep.
New York, Nashville, New Orleans, Austin, LA.
Yep.
It's like you're going on a countrywide tour.
Yeah.
You're basically like a musician touring from place to place. People are hearing you speak. What is that experience like? I know you've spent a long time on the internet, but what's it like when 100 people or more are willing to show up to see you speak? And many of those people, I'm sure you've never seen or you don't know them, but they know you. What's that like?
I've gotten used to it over time. At first it was odd. Like I remember it was probably 2013 of doing some early blogging and I went to this conference called MicroConf, which was about building like self-funded small software companies. So there's a lot of people maybe selling WordPress plugins or iPhone apps or that kind of thing. And that was the community that I was in. And with the first iPhone apps that I built and the first books that I wrote, I published blog posts about how much money they made and you know what I learned in the process and all of that. And so kind of the juxtaposition between two events. I went in 2011, I went to a web design conference called An Event Apart, which is the people who basically invented web standards and the way we use CSS today and all of this stuff, which is the world that I was in, hosted this conference. And so all of my web design heroes were there. I went to the conference, super introverted. I didn't talk to anyone. And I had this moment walking along the Seattle waterfront where I left the venue and I realized those are all the like conference speakers out in front of me, right? Because they're all friends. They're all hanging out. And I realized like, oh, they're walking the same, like we're staying at the same hotel, you know? And so I like walked a little faster to like catch up with them. And like, oh, I'm going to like join this conversation. We're going to meet. And like, of course, I read your article. Like, it's, oh, so great. And then I was like, no, there's no way that I'm going to like introduce myself. Like, I don't even introduce myself to the person sitting next to me in the like theater as we're, you know, at this conference. Like, there's no way I'm going to talk to the speakers at this event. So I like kind of drop back, right? And then I'm like, no. This is your chance, right? You've read all their articles. And so then I kind of start to walk a little faster and like, you know, and then I'm like, yeah, there's no way. And I drop back. And so it's like this like yo-yo, you know, of me like trying to build up the confidence and then never mind. And so I kind of drop back and I'm discouraged and frustrated that like, I don't, you know, I don't know, have the confidence and courage to join the conversation. So I drop back, they go into the hotel. I walk in after them. And I realize like by the time I walk in, they've like sat down in the hotel lobby. And it was that setting where it's not a fixed number of tables. Like you could totally join in and it would have been fine. And I like walk, I look at that and I keep going to my room.
Damn.
And so like, and I kept thinking about that moment, like, oh, all of the people that I follow on the internet are like right there. And I, you know, why would they want to talk to me? I don't want to start that conversation, you know? And so that like stuck with me of like, okay, who's the kind of person I actually don't want to have to put myself out there. to have to like introduce myself or be outgoing, or I don't have some story of like my good friend Sahil Bloom had a story the other day of, he's like in a hotel in Vancouver for an event, and he, you know, he posts on Instagram a lot, and so he's got his daily routine and all that. And so someone who wanted to meet with him figured like, oh, he's going to be in the hotel gym at 6 a.m. So they like hustled their way in, you know, like caught a door and worked their way in.
We'll put the tweet up here on the screen. This is an incredible story that I'm like, I immediately was like, this is the best thing that I've seen on the internet today. Just the fact that he would go and have a coffee ready for Sahil, yeah, and then run with him. So I think you're making the point of like, I'm not that type of person.
I'm not that guy, right? This guy had, as Sahil talked about in his tweet, like that immigrant hustle and energy of like, look, this is what it takes and I'm going to do that. And I was like, oh, that's totally not me. Mm-hmm. So if you fast forward 2 years, I've built a little bit of an audience online, right? I have an email list of at least 1,000 people at this point, you know, so it's going somewhere. But within this community, I've written blog posts about what works and all that. And I went to MicroConf, this event in Las Vegas, and I was talking to people. One, I knew a bunch of the speakers. I was delivering like a quick lightning talk, you know, and I was had this moment standing in a circle of like 10 people or so, and we're all talking and all that. And someone comes in and is just like, oh, hi, I just had to say hi. If my friends knew that I was at a conference with Nathan Berry and I didn't say hi, they wouldn't ever let me hear the end of it.
Wow.
And a couple of things stood out to me. Like one, I was like, first of all, as an introvert, blogging is the best thing because now I don't have to introduce myself to anyone. They'll like, I want to talk to all these people. I just don't want to start the conversation. So now they'll all start the conversation. Like, this is fantastic. Everyone should write on the internet. Mm. But then the other thing is realizing that the power that those words have, right? The difference, there is not a substantial difference between me in Seattle and then 2 years later in Las Vegas, right? Like I had many of the same skills. I was a little bit further along in my career, but the difference is that the person in Las Vegas had put work out there publicly, right? I had been teaching everything that I know, you know, I'd done things and shared the story about it. And that made people want to follow me and made people want to talk to me. And so just realizing like, oh, wow. There's nothing that special about people putting out content on the internet and those who like are sitting behind the scenes consuming it. Like it, we're like, wow, we're worlds apart. And it's actually like, no, you're like slightly different, you know?
Absolutely.
There is a 10% difference in where you're putting your energies, you know, or something. It's not huge.
Yeah. And I'm curious how you would think about that situation today of, let's say there's some people you follow online and they're having a conversation and you're behind them. What would you do today?
Yeah. So one thing that I've started to do, because I have a bunch of people that I kind of know, right? From maybe we've had some interactions on Twitter, that kind of thing. I remember I was at Social Media Marketing World in San Diego years ago, and I had some traction with ConvertKit, but it wasn't huge. Or I was speaking at a handful of events, that kind of thing. And I remember Chris Brogan had spoken and he had a big group of people around him, right? And so he was out there and was like, okay, I met Chris like a month ago at another event. And I like want to say hi to him, but I don't want to wade through that group of people. Hmm. And I was trying to think, and I said, what would I do if I was important?
Hmm.
And obviously everyone's important.
Mm-hmm.
But like maybe if I decided that I was important, I act that way. And so what I did, and I've done this many times since then because it worked quite well, is I cut past the entire line, walked right up, and was like, oh, hey, Chris, good to see you again. Remember, we met at Pioneer Nation, you know, 2 months ago or whatever, like Nathan Berry. And he's like, oh, Nathan, good to see you. Yeah. Hey, you've got, like, you talk to everybody. I'll catch up with you later. And I left. Right. Because, like, you got your fans. You know, we're friends.
I'm important.
They're fans. They're fans. And so it was interesting. Is everyone else, you know, you see these interactions where people want something, right? They want some of your time. They want you to, you know, who knows what. Like, then it was like, give a backlink to their blog or like, who knows? And if you're the person who doesn't want anything, it stands out in a totally different way, right? I didn't even want any of his time. I was the one to end the conversation. sooner. It's not like, well, okay, well, I got the next people to talk to, so let me, you know, it's like, oh no, you do that, like, I'll catch up with you later. And sure enough, you know, we were at another, there was like another meetup that happened later, and I saw Chris, and he wasn't surrounded with a bunch of people, and I was like, oh, good to chat, you know. And I was just like, oh, did you, how'd the, you know, like, I didn't say this, but it's basically like, how'd the fan meet and greet go, you know? But I think it's the same thing, like, you know, if you think, if you're out in public, right, and you see someone who's just absolutely nailing their outfit, right, and you give them a compliment on it, if you like stay and linger, like for us as guys, if a girl walks by and you like give her a compliment, probably the first reaction is like, what do you want, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, you're hitting on me or something else. But if you go the other route and you just like give someone a compliment and you're gone, right, then it's like, oh, that was just a compliment, you know? And so thinking about in those interactions, how you set that up, how you follow up later. But like, yeah, I would do it entirely differently. And I have many times where, one, being, if you're the one speaking or something else, you're in the green room and that's actually the place to meet people. But then the other side of, yeah, in that interaction, I would go in, say hi, love your content, all that. And instead of lingering or something else, I would end the conversation and I would be the one to leave, unless there was like a very obvious open to like stay and hang out. Or I would leave and go do something different and then maybe come back at some point.
I love how deeply you've thought about these social scenarios and situations. And
can you tell I'm a photo extrovert?
Of course. It's so cute. Like, is the best way I can describe it. I'm just like, wow, like, There is such a breakdown of social situations that some of it comes naturally, I guess, or just like, I just don't think about it that deeply.
Yeah.
Which is like so wonderful that there is actually a side, and there is a, like, when you look at someone and you're like looking up to them versus when you're thinking you're important and you're on the same playing field as them,
yeah,
that's an entirely different interaction that leaves both parties feeling differently. And so I think we're aware of this, and I often just don't think about it, I guess. But I really,
in those situations, what do you like? Are you just the one who goes in and talks to whoever, and you're like, "Hey, this is how opportunities are made. Like, let's get things done."
The whole world is my oyster. I can talk to any person, anytime, any place, anywhere. And I honestly have the podcast as responsible for that,
right?
Because I feel so comfortable in every moment. I don't want anything from anyone. I just want people to be happy. I want people to be free. I want people to love themselves and love the moment. And because I do, and I genuinely want that for other people. So I think that I don't have any pressure on myself. And I don't think like, if I do this, then this person's going to do this and what's going to happen here. I just think like, if someone doesn't like me or whatever, that's all good. That's part of life.
Yeah.
You know? So
there's plenty of more people and whatever else.
Yeah. And I also love how you said like, the world started coming to you by virtue of you writing online. And
have you seen that happen with the podcast?
Of course. I mean, if you put out enough content over enough period of time, people are going to start gravitating towards it. And it leads you to be an exciting person to talk to. Mm-hmm. So you have a great, you're like, how do you go? How do you do that? Like, how do you go from consumer to creator? And you have 13 steps here in a Twitter thread that I thought was very good, which is, first, set a daily make something goal. Mm-hmm. 2, document what you want to make. 3, decide before you start. 4, separate creation and consumption. 5, know who you serve. 6, schedule time for creation. 7, quit Slack. 8, teach what you just learned. 9, build a streak and don't break the chain. 10, block troublesome sites. 11, know your outcome. 12, create a deadline, raise the stakes, and 13, go public. I love that, right? And if someone wants to rewind that or check out the Twitter thread link below, it's very useful because I think a lot of people listening to this might be in this position of, I want people to come up to me, or I want it to be easier. And I think it being easier for you is a result of the work. So if someone's in that position right now, like, what is the advice in that Twitter thread?
Well, I think the first thing of like, it's having that daily goal to make something. Hmm. There's enough times that maybe you're watching a great YouTube video or an indie film or something, and you're like, oh man, I would love to make that.
Or a podcast,
any of those things, right? Where you're saying, you realize you spend all this time consuming, and there's this moment where you feel like you have better taste than the person making it. And so like, I could do better. And it's like, all right.
Try.
Prove it, you know? And not in a like, I don't think you can do better, but in a like, great. I love that you see this. And you're like, oh, I could do better than that. I have great taste. Like, absolutely. Let's make this happen. And so I think that make something goal, you know, for a while I had a sticky note on my monitor that should make something.
Wow.
Right? Like, what are you going to make? So that's the first thing, right? If you're getting out there and whatever your craft is, if you're continually actually showing up and making something, that's good. But the second thing is the step of either sharing the progress of what you're making, like show the behind the scenes, how is this made? How is this done? Or teaching, right? This is how to do X, Y, and Z. Actually, probably one of the most impactful moments in my career came probably 2011, somewhere around the 2010. And I was working as a web designer and I was constantly learning new things, right? So CSS, HTML, JavaScript, all this stuff. And I wrote, like, I built a lot of websites for people. And I remember coming across this website called CSS Tricks. And I would refer to that website. I saw when it was launched. And this guy, Chris Coyer, would put out articles. And I remember looking at that and going, okay. Like, I thought you were, like, actually thought, I thought you were, like, supposed to be an expert, but I know that. Right? And I was like, okay, well, I am pretty good at web design, so maybe he's pretty good. And he put out another thing. I was like, I know that already too. Okay. And I like went through a bunch of these articles and he was teaching stuff that I already knew. And then eventually he'd maybe there'd be something that he would teach, he would format. I'm like, okay, that's better explained than I would be able to explain it. So I was working at a software company at the time and someone would ask like something obscure, like CSS specificity, which is a very like niche thing in front end development. And instead of me explaining it to them, I'd be like, well, Chris like wrote a really good article about it. So like, go read that, you know, it saves me time. But we kind of had this process of like doing development work, learning new things as you did it, and then applying that next project. But then what happened, like really threw me for a loop, because Chris put out this article and said, hey, I want to take time off of my freelancing job. And I want to like really take CSS Tricks as a website and a community to the next level. So I've got this Kickstarter and I'd like to raise $3,500 in order to take that bit of time off to do these things. And if you back the project, I'm going to make these tutorials and I'm going to share more behind the scenes and you can learn more as I, you know, spend a month doing this. I'm like, all right, let's see where this goes. He ends up raising something like $85,000.
No way.
On this Kickstarter project. And I'm like, hold on a second. Chris and I are the same. We're both like intermediate to advanced web developers now at this point, right? Like he does freelance work. I do freelance work. But he has his ability to like flip a switch and make $80,000 or $90,000 off of Kickstarter. And I have none of that ability. And so I had to recognize that we're not the same. There is something different in this. And so I went back and I was like, okay, what's happening here? He's learning something, like doing a web design project, learning something, applying that to the next project, and on and on. Same thing. What's different? And I realized he had another step in there. He would learn something, apply it to another project, teach it to an audience, and go on from there. And so once I realized that, I developed this mantra of teach everything you know. And we have it on ConvertKit shirts. We have it on all of us. Right? Someone would say, oh, I can't teach. I'm not an expert. And that's how I felt initially. And then I was like, Chris isn't an expert either. I realized later that like he 100% is. And something that really stuck with me once I learned it is everyone, like people don't teach because they're experts. We perceive them as experts because they teach. So it's a chicken and egg thing and we have it backwards. And so I basically switched it and said, don't wait until you're an expert to start teaching. Like you have this thing that you learned that you're probably in a better position to teach. Right around the time I was learning to program in Ruby on Rails. And there were some pretty basic things that I hit as stumbling blocks, right? You get it installed on your computer. And I went through the articles written by the experts and they were confusing. Because they skipped over details that were super obvious to them. But I ended up finding an article by someone who had like just learned it. And they're like, here's what I got stuck on. And I was like, I got stuck on the same thing. Turns out I wanted to follow someone who was like 2 steps ahead of me, not 100 steps ahead of me. And when I realized that, I was like, oh, I can start teaching about designing iPhone apps because the iPad had just come out and I was learning about that. Like, well, let me teach what I'm learning right after I learn it. And then as we go from there, you know, it puts you in this really interesting place. And so that lesson from Chris was basically like, oh, you have to teach. And from then on, I've stayed consistent with a blog or a newsletter for the last, you know, 12, 13 years since then. And basically an incredible amount of good things in my life have come from being the person who says, like, not only am I going to make something, but I'm also going to teach about it. I'm going to share the journey. And then people love to follow along.
I can't help but wonder if the reason why you don't or never thought of experts, quote unquote, on a pedestal is because you were homeschooled. Hmm. I was thinking about this myself, and why do I have a tendency sometimes to want to be like, this person's going to solve all my problems? It's because the teacher told me that. Hmm. And when the teacher told me that I got an A, that meant that my parents were happy and that
that's where the validation came
exactly,
from.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so what I think people have done is replace the teachers with modern gurus or people teaching them business or people teaching them web design or whatever it is. Like, that's my new teacher and I need to impress the teacher. But you didn't really have teachers. I mean, your teachers were your parents in some sense, but you didn't have the same relationship that most of the population has had, which might have caused them to put people in a light on a pedestal that they otherwise wouldn't have.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And I mean, so much of what I learned, my parents were like, there's the book, read it. You know, I remember a time going to the library and I came back with a stack of books and I was like, Mom, I don't know if this is enough books. And I was like, she's going, like, I think there's plenty of books. And I'm like, but you said we're not going back to the library for 2 weeks. And she's like, yeah, you got 10 books. I think you'll be okay. You know? And that was always the thing that, like, we just spent so much time reading. And so then when it came time to learn web design, people are like, oh, you're entirely self-taught. That's amazing. I'm like, I mean, kind of. I'm like self-driven and my teachers are just all of these other bloggers and content creators who are, you know, building web standards and like figuring out all the stuff in web design. And so I've just always had that, like, basically I'll go learn from whoever has the best content that I can find. And then wait, there's actually a lot of topics where I can have the best content. And so it turns out I can be one of those teachers as well.
Well, I think there's an important point in there, and that is you found the best content. How does one find the best content?
Oh, you go through a lot of crappy content along the way to find it. I mean, it's so interesting thinking about discovery now versus back in the day. Before, so much discovery was either through search and SEO or through like blog rolls or guest posts, right? I don't even know how, but I came across Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek and then his blog. And then through reading his blog, I read a guest post by Chris Guillebeau, who's written a lot of amazing content. And this is in, I don't know, 2012. And I went to his site and it was one of those times, I don't know if you've ever had this experience where you like binge read someone's entire website.
Of course.
Just like, all right, this is what I'm doing now. Because Chris was talking about how to earn a living on the internet, how to travel, you know, what it means to build an audience, you know, at a time when he was one of the early pioneers at doing it well. And so a lot of this was like guest posts and blog rolls of how you discover more people. And the things I learned from Chris like shaped so much of my online career. Build an email list, sell products, you know, the whole way that he would price and package ebooks and courses and all of that. You know, he was a pioneer in so much of that. But yeah, like discovery is an interesting thing. Now, like, it's all what will YouTube, LinkedIn, Instagram algorithms, you know, how does that work? Which there's lots of great ways, you know, lots of ways to get great content featured in that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. How have you seen, like, how do you think about discovering great content?
Dude, I think about it like a feeling I get. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, this speaks to my soul in this moment.
Okay.
Like, it's like very, it's a spiritual thing. Honestly, when I find a person or a group of people who I'm like, yes. And it's like a full body lights up.
Is there an example of coming across someone recently who does that?
You know, in the past month or so, I've really been tuning into myself more than I have other people.
Okay.
But in the past, it's been people like Alex Hormozi.
Yep.
You know, David Perel was a huge one for me in 2020. So in 2020, when I started putting myself out there on Twitter as my real name, before it was like Danny Roars because I was uncomfortable with myself. And I went as an alias. And so I saw David Perel and I was like, this guy's interested in ideas and this guy's interested in writing and he's doing the internet in a way that I want to be doing it.
Yep.
And so that to me felt like a full body yes. Like I need to study this man and figure out what's going on here. So those are like a couple of examples. But I think breaking down that process of what lights you up is such an important thing. And forget like, I'm thinking about it like from a spiritual place, but just like from an intellectual place of like, this person's a good teacher and this person's not. What separates those two in your mind?
I think it's really tough because I think it's really who's a good teacher for you, right? Because you're going to end up with a lot of things. Most things on the internet have been said before, right? Here we are, both of us running podcasts. We're putting out a lot of content. Not that much that we say is original, right? We're learning from other people. We're synthesizing it. And we're just sharing in a way that spoke to us. And a lot of it is going to come down to who you see represented, right? So like an example, in the design world, there were people like Jason Fried and David Hennemeyer Hansen from Basecamp who had talked about self-publishing. They'd written a book called Getting Real, and they'd self-published it. And it had made something like $400,000 or $500,000. Wow. And they had this article talking about like, you should self-publish it as well. And I remember thinking like, yeah, you and I are not the same, right? Like you have a blog read by hundreds of thousands of people. And I don't at all, right? That's not a path for me. I came across Chris Guillebeau's work and it seemed more approachable, right? Here's an individual, not a company here, you know, and I learned from that, but still he had an audience and I didn't. And then in early 2012, a blog or a site that I read a lot was called Hacker News, news.ycombinator.com. And it purely by chance, these two designers, Sasha Grief and Jared Drysdale, had released ebooks about design on the same day, and both had trended onto the homepage of Hacker News.
Separately.
Separately. Like they did not know each other at all, like a pure chance.
What?
And they were both, I bet they would say they were both a little bit miffed of like, what? Like, this is my launch day. You know, there's someone else.
They didn't know? That's crazy. That's like universal.
Yeah.
You know, where inventions happen at the same time sort of thing.
Yeah. So what was interesting is they both had very different pricing models. So Jared had written a full length like ebook about design and he was charging, I think, $39 for it. And Sasha had written, like his was called Step-by-Step UI Design. And basically he'd taken a single design project and used that to teach the principles of design. And he was selling it for like $3 if you got just the ebook or $6 if you got the like Photoshop files with it. And that was the launch pricing and it was going up to $6 and $12 after the launch pricing ends, right? So they're completely different models. And Jason Cohen, the founder of WP Engine, sees this. And he's like, this is fascinating. Like, you guys have totally different models, same day release, like all this. And they both didn't really have an audience. Like, they had audiences of, you know, in the hundreds of people or maybe 1,000 across all their social platforms and all that. So Jason Cohen invites both of them to guest post on his blog. And he's like, each of you write articles about how your launch went, what you learned, and why your pricing model is better. Because, you know, it was basically like higher price, fewer sales, lower price, more sales. What was fascinating is they both made almost exactly the same amount of money.
What?
One of them made about $8,000 in the first 48 hours, and the other made $7,000. So Jared, with a higher price, did fewer sales, but ended up doing more revenue, and Sasha, with the lower price, did a lot more sales and all that, and it was fascinating. But what stood out to me in it is I looked at it, and I could see myself in what they were doing. right? Here were two designers. I'm a designer who had small audiences. I didn't really have an audience, you know? And I was like, wait, they could make that amount of money? I could do that, right? And so it ended up being 6 months later that I published my book, The App Design Handbook. It ended up making $12,000 in the first day, $19,000 in the first week. I took a hybrid approach where I went with higher pricing and multiple price tiers.
Mm.
And then, you know, ended up being a full year later, I wrote a guest post for Jason Cohen's blog about how I had the best pricing model. And that was a lot of fun. And people have referenced like all three of those articles together. But one thing that stood out to me is lots of people had made money self-publishing ebooks before. But I'm forever grateful to Sasha and Jared for writing about their experience, because I could see myself in that. When I saw that, I was like, oh, that I could do. And so I think it's not about good content and bad content. It's about, though there is some objectively bad content out there where you're just like, what are you doing? Many of which I've created 10 years ago. But it's really about looking at, you know, how can you put in your unique perspective? Because it's going to resonate with someone.
Yeah, that's really well said. And I'm curious, when you think about what the internet was back, I mean, this is so exciting for me because I'm learning about like the prehistoric days.
And there's someone who's going to be like, what? Nathan can't talk about 2010 and the early days of the internet? That is bullshit. You know, like,
dude, I love this so much because I feel like the internet in some sense is like my home, you know, and I feel like learning about this stuff is so fascinating of like, this is how people created back in the day. Like, what has surprised you about the last 15 years since you've been online about creating specifically?
Oh man. I mean, there's so much that is changing. One, I'm still just in awe that this is a job that we get to do and get paid for it. Like, did you know you can make more money than a doctor instead of 8 years of school and then like residency where you're making like 40 grand a year and working an obscene amount? Like, you could just write stuff on the internet. Like, that is absolutely wild. I feel like we understand something and other people are out there just like doing their normal careers. I'm like, did you know that like an audience on the internet is worth insane amounts of money? Like, attention is power. Like, this is wild. So, I mean, that's the first thing. Like,
it still surprised you that much to this day as it did back in the day? Or
like, I mean, I deeply understand it. You know, this is my world that I've immersed myself in. I feel like when I think about it, I still have the same kid in a candy store feeling of like, this is the best.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is just watching it grow. Mm. Right. So Chris Guillebeau wrote this book called 239 Days to Overnight Success, which I just love. Right. Before like Mark Manson was writing The Subtle Art or the book like the life-changing magic of tidying up. Mm. You know, I like these titles that have these twists on them where you're like, the life-changing magic of tidying up, you know. Chris would write, he had one called A Brief Guide to World Domination.
I love that.
and then 279 Days to Overnight Success, you know, has that same twist in the title.
Mm.
But in it, it was his journey to making a full-time living as a content creator. I think he wrote it in probably 2010, maybe. And the numbers that he talks about in there, you can still find it on the internet, like $63,000 a year. That was his mark of full-time living, right? And he was able to travel the world. He then started a quest to visit every country in the world, and he blogged about that and everything on from there. And he's gone on to make many millions of dollars as a content creator. But what was interesting to me is someone then making a full-time living or six figures as a content creator, like, that was wild.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to Leo Bauta, who
Zen Habits,
you know, Time Magazine named it one of the top 25 websites that makes the internet great, you know, in 2007 or something like that, right? The audience that he had then, I think, was probably 10,000 email subscribers.
No way.
Right? Like, it's...
I was reading it then.
Yeah. I think it was about 10,000 email subscribers. Might have been as high as 20, but I guarantee it was not more than that.
That breaks my brain. Like
the audience on the web was very, very small. Right? And so if you think about the growth in audience numbers between then and now, so the last 15 years or so, it is absolutely insane. Like, I get to see everyone's email lists running ConvertKit, and like, there's 10,000 creators or more that have over 10,000 subscribers. So like, more subscribers than Leo Babauta had when Time Magazine was like, and they, it wasn't based on audience size that they were saying that, they were saying it based on his content and everything. But, you know, there's tons and tons of all these creators out there. So audience sizes are way bigger. The next thing is the ability to earn a living off of an audience is way, way better. So like pricing, willingness to pay, you know, a $6 ebook. No, like charge this, charge $500 for a cohort-based course, charge $2,000, right? All of these things, it's legitimized in a way. So the willingness to pay is much higher. Revenue per subscriber, you know, you got automation, you can track all these things. You can, the sophistication is so, so much better than it was. And so when you combine audience size and willingness to pay and then like sophistication of what works, and you basically multiply all of those things, then revenue earned as a creator is just absolutely through the charts, right? If someone was talking about way back then, like someone making $100,000 a year was insane. $1 million a year, there were a couple people, you know, Ramit Sethi, Marie Forleo, a handful of these people in like, you know, 2012, 2015, that kind of thing, doing it. And now, like, I literally know 200 or 300 creators who are making over $1 million a year from their content. And so I don't see it as like then and now. Like, that chart is just continuing, right? And so you're going to have way more people. And so it's an insanely exciting time to be a content creator, because you're like, wait, I get to continue to benefit to ride this wave. And some people might say like, oh, is it too late? No, not even close. You know, like, so in 2020 could be like, oh, podcasting is saturated, right? Like, it probably was. And now it's 5 times bigger. And, you know, in a few years, you know, you get things like Travis and Jason Kelsey with their podcast, right? It's taken off in an insane way. And it was doing really well. And then you get Taylor Swift involved, and, you know, it's way, way bigger than that. And so all of that is bringing people into podcasting in a way that has never happened before. And so I just look at all of these mediums that we use as creators, and I'm like, they're all going to be 5 times bigger in 5 years. And the potential is so big for those people who are willing to show up and put in the work.
So someone hears that and they're feeling really excited now, because I'm feeling excited and you're selling me the Kool-Aid and I'm drinking it completely. And I've been drinking it.
Yep.
So it's not hard for me to continue drinking it. And they want to know, what should I take from this episode, and what should I actually do? What's a challenge that you can leave someone with after listening to us for the past hour and some time and actually do something in their day-to-day life that will make a meaningful difference if they stick to the challenge?
Yeah, I think the first thing is, if you can show up with an actual skill, that makes a huge difference, right? I've seen people who are like, I'm going to teach you online business. And it's like, oh, cool. What businesses have you built? This one that I'm building right now to teach online business. And you're like, really? So I think—
Does that frustrate you, by the way?
It does.
Yeah, I can sense it.
Because the reason that it frustrates me is not because it's like gatekeeping people out of the creator world. Mm-hmm. It's that you end up seeing this bad advice where someone's like, oh, just do this thing. And you're like, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
And on one hand, you're like, oh, you know, bad advice never hurt anybody. And it's like, no, there's some kid out there who's like, oh, this is all it takes, and I just have to follow what this person says. You see this in the book launch world where people are like, yeah, I just wrote a great book. And it's like, no, you actually bought 10,000 copies of your own book. And that, you know, it's like, just don't lie about it.
Yeah.
You don't have to say anything, but don't say like, this is how to do a book launch, when there's actually something entirely different that happened behind the scenes. So I think that, you know, if you're going to teach everything you know and put this content out there, you should do it in something that you're actually an expert in. Hmm. So like, go and figure out, like, go and hone a craft as a designer, a developer, a copywriter, a podcast producer. Like, what does it take to make great audio for a podcast? Like, or what does it take to be a great interviewer? Like, truly study that craft, and have that be the thing that you teach and share, rather than looking around and saying like, well, what niche could I make money in? You know, that sounds good. I'll just clone her business. You know, and it's like, you're not going to last. Like, you can't have that patience and longevity if that's your model. So the first thing I think is build a real skill. And it could be almost anything, right? I've seen people make, there's this woman named Bonnie Christine who makes $2 to $3 million a year as a fabric pattern designer.
What?
Not a bad gig. You know, and she's an incredible designer, amazing teacher as well. And you know, I love her and her content, you know, but in all of these different niches. You take Pat Flynn, right? He was an architect. He got his start online because he had all of his notes to study for the like LEED exam for, you know, green building design. And he put them on the internet. And turns out people found them and were studying off of his notes.
Unreal.
And so, you know, he was an expert in the thing and he used that to hone the craft. Even James Clear.
Mm.
James Clear, before he started jamesclear.com, had a blog called Passive Panda. And that was where he was like, I'm going to hone my craft over here. And then I'm going to go, you know, this is my practice grounds. And then I'm going to go do the thing that I ultimately want to build. And so I think build the craft and study that. And then really do two things. One, teach everything you know. So share that journey share what you're learning and teaching. And then the second thing is work in public.
Hmm.
Like show the behind the scenes. What are your goals? What are you trying to do? Like when I started ConvertKit, I said, hey, I'm doing the web app challenge. I'm going to try to build a company to $5,000 a month in recurring revenue within 6 months. And I'm going to live blog every week. Here's what I'm learning. Here's my progress I made and all that. And it didn't work out, right? Like I did not hit the goal. I didn't even get halfway there. I was like a third of the way. But like it turned into something amazing. I met all kinds of people. And so if you want to create an audience on the internet, and you have the thing that you're teaching, you have your skill and your craft, and you're showing up consistently for a long period of time, show up every day for at least 2 years. You are not allowed to say like, is this work? For at least 2 years. And then when you have those things, like you're going to be in so much better of a position of being able to, I don't know, create something amazing and good things will come from it. And I guess to bring it full circle, also figure out what are you measuring success on that you actually control, right? Because that's the thing. If it's like, oh, I just want to meet amazing people. Like there is nothing better than putting words or, you know, in written form or audio form or whatever on the internet. Like, but if you put that success in forms of like, my goal is to get 1 million collective views on Instagram. It's like, all right, good luck, but you're in a world of hurt. Oh, one other thing in that is go on a journey that other people can root for you on.
Yes.
Right? Let's say hypothetically you wanted to sell out Madison Square Garden. Right? That's like people are like, oh, what are you doing with this podcast thing? Right? And you're like, you can clearly say, this is what I'm doing. There's a YouTuber named Matt Diavella who has a fantastic podcast and YouTube channel and all of that. And I don't know if he's still doing this, but for a long time, he had this quest to get The Rock on his show. And he even had like this in his studio, there's like this framed photo of The Rock and became this little gag that over time they like cut to that, they do a little check-in on it. And that was the funny version of it. But just having this goal, and if you're deliberately and constantly working towards that goal, then people are going to want to come alongside you and try to make that happen. And so that's, yeah, I think show up consistently, hone a craft, work in public and teach, and then go on a journey that is worth following.
You've done all that. And it's cool to have you as a virtual mentor and someone that I can talk to now.
Yeah.
It's like, this is the craziest thing in the world and so cool for me. And it's cool to hear that that's still happening for you. Of the people that are inspiring to you are reaching out to you and you're like, this is the coolest thing in the world. And it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to be able to meet your heroes or meet people who really inspire you and for them to be amazing people and for them to continue to inspire you. So
yeah, for sure.
Thank you for being one of those people for me.
Oh, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
And at Nathan Barry, if you want to follow this man on Twitter, anywhere else we should send people, ConvertKit.com, yep. NathanBarry.com, yep. Billion Dollar Creator, new podcast. Anywhere else?
Yeah, I write a newsletter every Tuesday. So just sign up at NathanBarry.com and it's fun to stay in the creator game even as a company founder. So go sign up there.
It shows that you really, like, this is part of your soul's mission and that it really is important to you. So yeah. I really love that. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good stuff.
Great work.
Let's see, Twitter, I want to go with this.
There we go.
Hey, what's up?